This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica stations. More than 100 people were killed in a chemical attack in Khan Sheikhoun, Syria, this week. Among the dead are a dozen or so children. Turkish doctors have conducted autopsies confirming that chemical weapons were used in the worst such attack in years. The United Nations Security Council met on Wednesday to roundly skewer the Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad and also condemn Assad's closest ally, Russia, for refusing to pass a resolution on the matter. Russia instead claimed that Syrian rebels likely killed the civilians in order to embarrass the government. U.S. Ambassador to the UN Nikki Haley held up photos of dead Syrian children and warned that the U.S. might take unilateral action on the matter. President Donald Trump also commented on the attack, implying that it was a game changer. Photos of victims of the attack choking and foaming at the mouth have horrified the world. Meanwhile, Islamic State rebels have reportedly killed 33 people in Deir Azor, Syria, execution style, and fired on people in Tikrit, Iraq, killing 22. My guest is Dr. Stephen Zunis. He's a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, where he serves as coordinator of the program in Middle East Studies. He's also the senior policy analyst for Foreign Policy and Focus, a project of the Institute for Policy Studies. Welcome to the program, Stephen Zunis.
Good to be with you again.
So first, I think, of course, it's important for us to establish the blame for this attack. Now, the Syrian government was accused of having conducted a similar attack in 2013. Is there, I mean, how confident, I should say, are you that the Syrian government is to blame for these sorts of chemical attacks?
I'd say around 95% from all the accounts. This was the weapons were dropped by aircraft. Obviously, the rebel groups do not have have an air force of any kind. A number of reputable human rights groups and other observers who have not been reticent to accuse ISIS of chlorine attacks or the U.S. or Israel of white phosphorus attacks, and have generally been pretty objective in their analysis of war crimes by all sides, appear to be convinced that this was indeed a Syrian government action. And so, you know, obviously, I don't know since I wasn't there, but, you know, again, the preponderance of evidence is pretty solid that it was indeed the Syrian regime that was responsible.
Now, a similarly horrific attack took place in 2013 when President Obama, of course, went to Congress to approve military action against Syria. That congressional vote failed. But at that time, I mean, that was 4 years ago. Over that four-year period, was there evidence established? Because you still have a lot of folks saying there is no evidence that the Syrian government is responsible.
The follow-up reports did seem to confirm that, again, it was indeed the Syrian government. I mean, there were some contrary voices. I'm not a technical expert on this sort of thing, but again, from everything I could see, the preponderance of evidence was that it was indeed the Syrian government. Now, it is quite possible, of course, that rebel groups have gotten a hold of some chemical agents. There's quite a bit of evidence that some rebel groups have used chlorine gas, which is the use of which is also illegal under international law, but it's not outright banned like sarin. And in both cases, both in Al-Ghouta and this most recent attack in Idlib, these were areas that have been held by rebel forces that were in key strategic locations. You know, that were blocking highways, that were getting in the way of the Syrian government consolidating its control over certain areas. So, you know, there was a degree of strategic logic in attacking these rebel strongholds, even though, of course, there were, as with many attacks, bombing attacks by not just the Syrian government, but the Russians and the United States have ended up killing a large number of civilians as well.
Absolutely, and that is something we should certainly be reminding ourselves about. If the rebels were the ones with access to these chemical weapons, wouldn't they have targeted Syrian military forces rather than civilians?
Exactly. I mean, if it's going to be a false flag attack or whatever, they would not have chosen such a strategic location that they're so desperate to hold on to. I mean, this is, and again, I'm a skeptic, as you know. I'm very much a strong opponent of U.S. military intervention in Syria. I was after the chemical attack in 2013. I remain a critic and an opponent of U.S. military intervention now. But that does not mean, though, that I can deny reality. And in this case, it appears that the Syrian regime is indeed responsible for these atrocities.
Now, do you feel that the Trump administration, in a way, greenlighted the Assad regime to do this sort of thing? It was just a week ago that the Trump administration made clear it was not going to go after Assad. Even Sean Spicer and Nikki Haley made clear that ISIS is the target. And some are considering that this gas attack was Assad's way of testing how far the Trump administration would go on holding him accountable.
Yeah, that is quite possible. I mean, even those of us who are very much opposed to U.S. and military intervention in Syria, you know, have been concerned that the Trump administration seemed to be denying, appeasing, the war crimes by the Assad regime. And yes, ISIS is bad news as well. But in their eagerness to go after ISIS, they seem to be downplaying, essentially, as in other ways where they've kind of cozied up to Russia, been willing to at least give a verbal condemnations of the atrocities of the regime. So it's possible, but my own view is that the Syrian government is doing things because they think they can get away with it, regardless of what the international opinion may be. And perhaps this emboldened them somewhat, but obviously the Syrian government has been just as many a number of rebel factions have been quite willing to engage in war crimes without worrying about international public opinion.
Let's talk about Nikki Haley's statements as well as Trump's statements. The United Nations Security Council met this week to pass a resolution. Russia opposed it, and there was strong criticism of Russia from all sectors, but also surprisingly, the Trump administration, which has so far been quite partial to Russia, maybe been accused of being too partial to Russia. Could this Syria attack... Well, actually, can you make sense of the Trump administration's reaction? Because there doesn't seem to be much coherence whether or not he wants to go after the Assad regime, whether or not he sees Russia as an ally.
Yeah, it's rather surprising, actually, to what degree that the United States has been willing to condemn Russia, given the failure to do so in so many other areas since the Trump administration came to office. I think in part just because chemical weapons, I mean, the stigma around this, especially sarin gas, is so extreme. I mean, politically, it would have been very difficult for the Trump administration to do otherwise. But it's interesting how they try to make political capital out. I mean, trying to blame the Obama administration for not going to war back in 2013, and instead agreeing to this United Nations-backed disarmament agreement that was actually promoted and negotiated in large part by Russia. And it's bizarre for a number of reasons. For one thing, it was Republican opposition that made approval of such an attack impossible. Again, I supported that personally. I support the opposition to it personally. But again, it was largely Republican opposition that made it legally impossible for the United States to intervene. And similarly, Trump himself at that time had a series of tweets where he came out in opposition to U.S. military intervention in response to the chemical weapons attack. So for him to turn around and blame Obama for it is ludicrous at face value.
Yes, in fact, this was one of Trump's tweets after the chemical bombing in 2013. He said, "Do not attack Syria," all caps. "If you do, many very bad things will happen." Now, that 2013 attack was on the same scale as what happened this week.
And it's even greater, actually. It's even larger, actually.
It was worse, yeah. And what happened this week, Trump basically said had a deep impact on him, that he was changed, his mind was changed. But really, what's changed is that in 2013, he wasn't president, and in 2017, he is.
Yes. And I mean, again, the disingenuousness of this, I mean, you got to be suspicious on a whole number of factors. And also, if you look at the history of the United States in terms of chemical weapons, the United States blocked efforts by Syria and other countries to create a weapons of mass destruction free zone in the greater Middle East, which was actually part of a UN Security Council resolution that led to the disarmament regime against Iraq. You see, Israel and Egypt, two close U.S. allies, have vast stockpiles of nuclear weapons, or sorry, chemical weapons. Israel also has nuclear weapons, of course. But the United States opposed any kind of comprehensive disarmament regime. Instead, the U.S. demanded, with threat of sanctions back in 2003, that Syria unilaterally disarm. And Syria basically said, no, we will disarm as part of a regional disarmament, but demanding we do it unilaterally is unfair. And similarly, of course, you know, the United States tried to largely destroy the Chemical Weapons Convention. We succeeded in firing the well-respected head of the OPCW. And indeed, the U.S. has done, under both Democratic and Republican administrations, done a lot to undermine any kind of comprehensive chemical weapons disarmament. In fact, the United States is in violation of the agreement right now because we're so far behind in disarming for our own chemical weapons. And so we really have no leg to stand on in terms of criticizing the Syrian regime for what it's done. And I should also point out that while the civilian deaths and everything are horrible because of this chemical weapons attack, let's remember that the United States itself has been responsible for more civilians in a bombing a couple weeks ago in West Mosul, some attacks on Raqqa. And of course, the United States used white phosphorus in Fallujah and elsewhere in Iraq during the height of the Iraq War. White phosphorus is a chemical weapon, and while it's not formally banned by the OPCW, its use is the use of these weapons is highly questionable legally. We defended Israel when they've used white phosphorus in Gaza. So there's hypocrisy all around on this issue.
And and meanwhile, of course, ordinary Syrians continue to suffer and die in huge numbers. It is so hard to remain unmoved when one has now seen the suffering of ordinary Syrians for so many years. And of course, the danger is that tragic occurrence that continues to happen can drive desperate people into calling for anyone to intervene militarily just to end the suffering. But we know and we've seen time and again that when despots and dictators and civil wars have destroyed countries, that U.S. military intervention has simply multiplied that destruction and not actually ended it.
Exactly. I mean, I think there's a tendency, I think, both on the right and the left to exaggerate American power. Those on the right will blame Obama or whomever for not intervening in Syria enough. The left will blame Obama or the U.S. government for intervening too much. But the fact is, in the case of Syria, with the important exception of ISIS, which is a direct consequence of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, the war in Syria, the atrocities by both sides would be happening regardless. And there's frankly not a lot the United States could do. Let's talk about Russia, though,
Stephen. I mean, Russia, many would suggest, is aligning itself so closely with the Assad regime as a counter to the U.S. having kind of cornered it militarily. Russia is seeking to expand its territory wherever it can. Could the U.S. not have some kind of diplomatic negotiation with Russia to give some kind of concession in exchange for backing off from supporting Assad and bombing Syria? Of course, the U.S. would have to address the fact that it too is bombing Syria.
Yeah. I mean, everything from the eastward expansion of NATO to U.S. military intervention in the Middle East. Let's remember that the Middle East is as close to Russia as Central America is to the United States. And the United States supported all sorts of horrific genocidal regimes in the name of countering supposed Soviet influence. And the reality is U.S. intervention in the Middle East is far greater than the Soviet interference in Central America ever was. And so, you know, you'd think the United States would therefore at least understand, though again, it certainly doesn't justify, the Kremlin's sense of being willing to support a tyrant like Assad. And the United States, I believe, could do something to assuage Russian, you know, fears by, for example, you know, stopping this eastward expansion of NATO, engaging in some provocative military exercises. And the fact that the United States has overthrown governments that were historically tied to Russia, like Iraq, and supported the uprising against Libya. I mean, Libya is actually a very interesting case because the Russians actually agreed to the establishment of a no-fly zone to protect the civilians from Gaddafi. And the United States, along with other NATO countries, went well beyond that mandate. Instead of simply establishing a no-fly zone to protect civilians, we ended up actually becoming the air force for the rebel army. And the fact that we abused that mandate has made Russia particularly defensive, and so they blocked even quite reasonable resolutions dealing with Syria on the idea that if you give America an inch, they'll take a yard, and that they don't want to risk anything like that. And so I think there's been certainly there's a lot that the United States has done in its policies in that region in recent years, which is and as well as in the Eastern Europe, which has fed this kind of Russian paranoia, which has led them to intervene in Syria on behalf of the Assad regime and some of the other questionable foreign policies they've pursued.
I think we can safely assume the U.S.'s military actions in the Middle East have always been belligerent and in the interests of the U.S. alone. And sadly, therein lies the conundrum. What about the United Nations Security Council, UN in general, rather? Mm-hmm. You know, back when the UN was founded, the idea was that an international body where governments could come together could deal with such threats, could deal with mm-hmm. these sorts of situations when you've had destructive government actions against a defenseless population. But of course, the UN is toothless. It does not have any kind of enforcement capability. And then it's always hamstrung by its member nations on the Security Council who've used it to advance their own interests. So is the UN a dead end?
I mean, it's better that we have it than we don't. I mean, they have been areas where they have made a difference. But, you know, when you see these kind of tragedies unfold, it's a reminder of their limitations. But let's also keep things in historical perspective. The Russians, in some cases with the support of the Chinese, have vetoed seven UN Security Council resolutions, so quite reasonable ones in my view, regarding a series of war crimes, the government's attacks against its own people, and efforts to try to get some kind of negotiated resolution, some of these of which also, of course, condemn the atrocities by the rebels. And again, these are quite reasonable. It was wrong for the Russians to veto it. Let's remember also, the United States has used its veto power 43 times as the only dissenting vote to protect Israel.
Yep.
From its responsibility for its war crimes and for peaceful resolution. And if anything, the United Nations has a stronger mandate when it deals with an international conflict or when it deals with a foreign belligerent occupation than it does with an internal conflict within a country's internationally recognized border. So again, this is no excuse for the Russian veto, but let's keep things in perspective.
Yeah.
And remember how the United States has done more than its share to undermine the authority of the UN Security Council in promoting human rights and world peace.
Let's finally end with what we could possibly do in one small constructive step on the Syria front. Andrew Bacevich, in an op-ed for the LA Times, wrote, "Trump is right. America isn't so innocent. Here's how we can right that wrong in Syria." And he basically concludes that we can do what the Germans have done, which is accept more Syrian refugees. Now, if Trump is so moved by the plight of the Syrians, that runs counter to his demonization of Syrian refugees who were singled out in his first Muslim ban as being indefinitely banned from the United States. That could be one place that he could make a small difference, offer some refuge for Syrians fleeing the violence of their country.
Exactly. I mean, and not just in terms of allowing them into the United States, but the amount of humanitarian support the United States has given to the refugees that are in the Middle East, that are fleeing the fighting in Syria, is just tiny compared to the massive amounts we spend on the militarization of that region. And I think it's just an example of the distorted priorities. Again, there's not a lot the United States can do for good or to improve the situation. I wish there was. In fact, in principle, I might even be open to military intervention if I thought it would do some good. But again, I've seen absolutely no evidence that it would. And but the area where we clearly could make a difference in terms of allowing refugees in and providing humanitarian aid, the United States has been very stingy. And so again, any talk about any humanitarian concern for the Syrian people, frankly, we should not take that seriously.
Stephen, always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for joining us today. We will continue to cover the story.
My pleasure. Thank you.
My guest is Dr. Stephen Zunis, a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, where he serves as coordinator of the program in Middle Eastern Studies. He's a frequent guest here on this program. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.